In honor of Hanukkah, starts this Friday, I thought it would be a nice idea to do a special Hanukkah share, because there is one animal which is inherently related to Hanukkah, and that is the leopard. Of course. Right? Ask anyone which animal is connected to this.
Because of the battle of the elephant.
The battle of the elephant just happens to be a historical connection between elephants and Hanukkah. It's not any connection between the essence of elephants and Hanukkah. If you're talking about the essence of an animal, then it's the leopard that relates to Hanukkah. It may sound weird, but in 45 minutes' time, you'll know all the reasons why. So let's start with the mentions of the leopard in the Torah. In source 1, we have a pasuk from Habakkuk. Their horses are lighter than Namerin. Namer is a leopard. What it says here, the horses are lighter than leopards, it's not talking about physical weight, it's talking about speed, that the horses are faster than leopards. And this tells you that leopards are fast animals. Right? That you want, when you want to say how fast a horse is, you say it's even faster than a leopard. Now you might think, well, perhaps Namer is actually a cheetah, not a leopard. Well, the second passage shows us that it must be a leopard. The second passage says, can the Ethiopian change his skin, or the Namer his blotches? So too can you in whom evil is ingrained do good. Right? The famous expression, can the leopard change his spots? But it doesn't say spots. Spots in Hebrew would be called nekudot. It doesn't say, can the namer change his nekudot? It says, can he change his chabab rosot? Chabab rosot means blotches, and that is therefore referring to a leopard. Because cheetahs have spots, whereas leopards have blotches. So that's how we know that namer refers to a leopard. It might also refer to a cheetah, that might also be included in the category, but the primary reference here is to a leopard. Okay? Now those two pasukim may not seem to have any added significance, but later we'll see how those pasukim tie in to the themes of the leopard elsewhere in the Torah. The third source is very important. It's from the book of Daniel. Daniel the prophet had a vision, a dream, in which he saw various animals. Daniel spoke and said, I saw in my vision by night four great beasts. The first was like a lion, and told other beasts, the second one, similar to a bear. Afterwards I beheld, and there was another, similar to a leopard, which had upon its back four wings and a bird. The beast had also four heads, and dominion was given to it. So in this dream, where Daniel sees different animals, it's referring to the different kingdoms which rose up against the Jewish people. Right, there were four kingdoms, four galios, four exiles, which have historically oppressed the Jewish people. Those are Bavel, Babylon, Parathumodai, Persia and Media, Yavon, Greece, and Edom, Rome. So the lion there in these verses, the lion represents Babylon. The bear represents Persia and Media. And the leopard, which is the third animal, represents ancient Greece. So the question is, why does the leopard represent ancient Greece? So you could say it's because the leopard is a very beautiful animal. And we know that ancient Greece was very into aesthetics and beauty. But there's more to it than that. Let's look at the Midrash in Source 4. As I saw in my vision another like a leopard, this is the fifth Yavan, Greece, which set up decrees and told Israel, write on the horn of an ox that you have no share in the world to come. Now, there's no obvious connection there between leopards and this decree made by Greece. So in order to understand what's going on here, we have to learn a little bit more about the nature of the leopard. Let's look at the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, in Source 5 and the Source Sheet. Okay? Yehuda ben Tamar said, be as brazen as a leopard, as light as a vulture, as swift as a gazelle, and as powerful as a lion to fulfill the will of your Father in heaven. The first one he mentions is, as Kanamer, be as brazen as a leopard. What does it mean to be as brazen as a leopard? So we'll take a look at Source 6, which is from Bill Clark. Bill Clark is the curator of the Chai Bar Nature Reserve. That's a nature reserve in the Negev Desert in Israel, very close to Eilat, where they concentrate on animals from biblical Israel. You see, Israel in biblical times had a lot more animals than it has today. It had lions, it had bears, it had crocodiles, it had leopards. Actually, it still has leopards. There are leopards wild in Israel today, There's four of them. They live in the Negev Desert near Ein Gedi. And, you know, there's just four left. The rest of them have been hunted to extinction. In fact, there's a sign in Ein Gedi saying, "Beware of leopards." And somebody has written underneath, "Watch out for polar bears too." Right, there are so few leopards in Israel, your chances of being attacked by one are about as great as your chances of being attacked by a polar bear. So Bill Clark writes as follows about leopards here in source 6. He says, "Leopards don't have the speed of a cheetah, nor can they claim the brute force of a lion. Instead, they rely on their wits. They're smart, and pound for pound, they're the scrappiest of the big cats. No other predator confronts its victims with such rampaging fury." Okay, so leopards are not the biggest of the big cats, they're not the strongest, they're not the fastest, but they're the boldest. Ascalama, they're the most brazen of the big cats. I was once watching wildlife documentaries about interactions between big cats and baboons. Oh, I can see we have a new addition to the class, Aubrey Abrams. Hi, Aubrey, give me your email address so I can send you the source sheet. Hi, Aubrey, emailing with you. Please give me... Okay, so I was watching these wildlife documentaries and it was showing how baboons are big cats. And if you remember, baboons are very powerful creatures. Large creatures are very strong, strong as a person, a very powerful set of teeth. So I was watching the baboons face off against cheetahs, and the baboons managed to see off the cheetahs, right? Baboons are big, strong, dangerous animals. But when it came to the leopard, one leopard was able to see off a whole troop of baboons. Send us email, Benjamin, you've lost sound. Anyone else lost sound? Benjamin seems to be a problem with your computer. Okay, Aubrey, I'm sending that email out to you right now. As soon as you get it, please print it out. Okay. Okay, sorry about those with intermittent sounds. Hopefully it will pick up. Okay, so leopards are tough, right, for their size. They'll take on enemies many times their size. They'll take on anything and everything with tremendous aggression. You may have seen my website where I have pictures and video footage of me with different animals. You'll see me with a tame lion, a tame bear. You'll see me alligator wrestling. I also have a video there of myself with a leopard. This was at a ranch where they train animals for movies. So they brought out this leopard. And they said, you know, leopards, they're not so easy to train. We're going to keep this one on its chain. So as I'm speaking to the camera with a leopard sitting in front of me, it suddenly turns around and dives for me, lunges upwards, you know, like that. So I jump backwards, and the trainer pulled the chain, and it wasn't able to reach me. But I'm telling you, as long as I live, I'll never forget the image of that savage ferocity on the leopard's face as it was lunging for me. After the class, you can look at my website, you can see that video. So that is the brazenness of the leopard. Now, what does it have to do with Greece? Greece was a brazen empire, firstly in terms of the speed with which Alexander expanded his empire, conquering every country in his wake. It was a brazen expansion to his empire. Then in terms of how he confronted the nations that he conquered, in that he made them give up. He made us, the Jewish people, he wanted to make us give up our religion, so he was brazen in that aspect. And that's what the Midrash is speaking about in source 4. That Yahweh set up decrees and told the Jewish people, you know, write down that you have no share in the world to come, that they forced us to give up certain festivals and mitzvot. So that was the brazenness of the Greek Empire, and that's why in Daniel's dream, in his prophecy, Greece was represented by a leopard. Now, if we think about this Mishnah in Source 5, we see that brazenness is not necessarily something negative, because here it's saying that we should be as brazen as a leopard to serve God. So that's a very important point to remember. No character attribute is entirely positive or negative. Attributes can be used in either way. They can be used for the good or for the bad. Okay, so the Torah, which is the precursor to the Shulchan Aruch, so that explains how we can use brazenness for the good, and that's in Source 7. Okay, discussing that Mishnah and Pirkei Avos. The Source 7 reads as follows. It specifies four areas in the service of the Creator, blessed is He, and it begins with be as brazen as the leopard for the good. Service of the Creator. So there are times when a person desires to do a mitzvah, but he refrains from doing it because there are people who are mocking him. Therefore, it instructs that a person should be brazen-faced against all those who mock him, and he should not refrain from doing the mitzvah. Similarly, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said to his students, may it be his will that the fear of heaven should be upon you as the fear of flesh and blood. That's referring to an incident when Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was on his deathbed. His students asked him for a blessing, and he said to them, may you be as afraid of God as you are of people. And they said to him, well, that's it. You know, shouldn't we be a lot more afraid of God than we are of people? So he said to them, how am I should be at least as afraid of God as you are of people? And very often, we're not as afraid of God as we are of people. When it comes to a clash between social pressure and doing the right thing, often we give in to social pressure. So that's why it's important to be brazen and to be able to withstand social pressure and persecution to do the right thing. Continues the Torah. Similarly, he's speaking regarding embarrassment, that sometimes a person is more embarrassed in front of people than he is before the Creator. Therefore, he warns that a person should be brazen in front of those who mock him and not be ashamed. Similarly, David said, and I shall speak of your statutes in front of kings, and I shall not be ashamed. Even though he was pursued and was slain from the heathens, he strengthened his Torah and studies, even though they were mocking him. Right, so it's giving King David there as an example of somebody who was brazen. And this is how brazenness can be a positive thing. Brazenness can be positive when it means that you're doing the right thing and you're not being intimidated. So coming back to the idea of Hanukkah, now there's an old joke. What's the definition of a Jewish festival? They tried to kill us, we won, let's eat. But truth is that Hanukkah is not just a military victory that we're commemorating. It's an ideological victory, and really the military victory itself stems from an ideological victory. It's because there was an attribute that Greece was using negatively, and we used that attribute for the good, that we therefore were able to conquer them militarily. How did we use that attribute for the good? Well, one way is that the Hashmonaim, the Hasmoneans and the Maccabees, they were brazen for the good in that they weren't intimidated. Even though they were outnumbered by the Greek army, they nevertheless stood up for themselves. Right, so that's a positive aspect. Victory of Hellenization, right. I'm going to get to this theme more soon. But simply at this stage, we can say that the Maccabees, even though they were outnumbered, but they fought brazenly. Right, so that was a positive aspect of brazenness. Now let's take a look at Source 8. This is Source 8 is a commentary to the Mishnah about being brazen as a leopard. So Beivadi Batanuris is as follows. He says, the leopard is born from a wild boar and a lioness. Right, a wild boar is a wild pig. For when lions get into heat, the lioness pokes her head into the forest thickets and roars to summon a mate. And the boar hears her voice and cohabits with her. The offspring of this pair is the leopard. Now, that is very weird. Right? He's saying that leopards are hybrids of pigs and lions. Now, how can that be? Okay? We know that leopards are not hybrids of pigs and lions. Number one, we can watch leopards giving birth in zoos and wildlife documentaries, and we see that leopards are born from other leopards. They're not some kind of bizarre hybrid of lions and pigs. Also, from a genetic standpoint, we know it's impossible. It's impossible for a pig and a lion to crossbreed. Lions are carnivores, pigs are omnivores. They are fundamentally structurally different. They are so genetically so far apart that that even if a very, very confused lion mated with an extremely confused pig, there wouldn't be any offspring as a result of that union. So what's going on here? So we might want to suggest that there's just a scientific error being made here. You could say that back in those days, people didn't know that lions can't crossbreed with pigs. But that's not the case. People did know that. Let's look at source 9 from the Ramban. Points out that one type cannot bear offspring with another type. Only those of similar natures can. So even back then, they knew that lions and pigs can't crossbreed. So what's going on here? The answer is that speaking metaphorically, as we mentioned earlier in the Book of Daniel, we had this idea of animals symbolizing different character traits. So Sonic Akar explains as follows in Source 10. He says, the boar represents the kingdom of Edom. The kingdom of ancient Greece is represented by the leopard. The smugging others of the Tashbets and the leopards to the mission of these brazen as a leopard says that the leopard is the illegitimate offspring of the lion and the wild boar, for the lion is Dandelion. Now what's going on here is that animals represent different attributes, and those attributes correspond to different nations. So the lion represents Babylon, and the pig represents Edom. So when we're saying that the leopard is a hybrid of the pig and the lion, what we're saying is that if you take the attributes of Edom and you combine those with the attributes of Babel, then what you get is the attributes of Greece. So metaphorically, it's giving over that idea. Now, with regard to what specific attributes are of Edom and Rome, I'm not going to get into that now. But the point I want to bring out from this is the idea that the leopard is an illegitimate hybrid. Right? That's what that's what we're being told here. That that Greece is a hybrid of different cultures, and that the leopard is metaphorically represents that. Now, even though obviously scientifically leopards are not the hybrids of lions and pigs, what's interesting is that there is a connection between leopards and the concept of hybridization. You see the pictures at the bottom of the source sheet? Anyone want to guess what they are? If you want to write an instant message and tell me what they are. Lions and leopards? Nope. No, neither lions nor leopards. Close. One of them, unfortunately I forget which, one of them is a leopon. A leopon. Let me just write that down so you can see it. One of them is a leopon. And one of them is a jaguar. Any guesses as to what a leopard and a jaguar is? Okay, very simple. A leopard crossed with a lion is a leopard. Jaguar crossbred with a leopard is a jaguar. We also have tigers crossbreeding with leopards. If you cross a tiger with a leopard, you get a and you can also cross a jaguar with a lion. Jaguar plus lion equals Lidjagulep. How do I spell this? Lidjagulep. These things are things that are born in captivity. But even in the wild, we see that it seems that leopards have a propensity to interbreed. Very unusual. Rick asked a good question. How can jaguars and leopards crossbreed if leopards are from Africa and Asia and jaguars are from America? It was done in captivity. Right? The cases I mentioned up there were all done in zoos and captive environments. But even in the wild, the leopards live in the same country as lions, and leopards are known to crossbreed with lions in the wild. And in India, there's a creature known as the Marozi, which is believed to be a natural hybrid of lions and tigers. So we see that in the we see that leopards, of all the big cats, leopards have the strongest propensity for crossbreeding, for hybridization. So again, this relates to the idea of Greece being a nation that hybridized the traits of Edom and Babel. Now, that's not the only way in which Greece represents the idea of hybridization. Let's look at the Gemara in Source 11. The elders of Athens, right, the wise men of Greece, they ask to be sure Ben Hananiah, when salt spoils, with what can one salt it? How do you preserve salt when it starts to spoil? Rabbi Yeshua replied, with the placenta of a mule. So the elders asked, but does a mule have a placenta? And Rabbi Yeshua replied, and does salt spoil? Okay, what's going on here? When the wise men of Greece spoke about salt, they weren't speaking about sodium chloride. Is that salt? Yeah. They were speaking about Torah. Now, they were speaking metaphorically. Salt is a preservative. In the days before refrigerators, if you wanted to stop food from spoiling, you'd salt it, right? So likewise, Torah is a preservative of the Jewish people. It's what keeps us going. But they said, now the salt itself is starting to spoil. Right? They said, now Torah itself is starting to be old-fashioned. It's out of date. It's not going to preserve the Jewish people any longer. You know, it's time to preserve the salt. What were they proposing? Mix in some Greek culture. Right? If you want to preserve the salt, you're going to have to mix in, if you're going to preserve Judaism, you're going to have to mix in some Greek culture, bring it up to date. Hellenize it. So Yeshua replied, you want to salt the salt? Use the placenta of a mule. Now what's a mule? Get a horse, get a donkey, put them together, you get a mule. Mules are amazing animals. They're very strong. They're very resistant to disease, this hybrid vigor. They're long-lived, hard-working animals. Fantastic animals to have on the farm. Just one little catch. What's the catch? Nobody gets the catch? The catch is this. Oh, right. You can't breed a mule. There's no such thing as a placenta of a mule. So, Rabbi Yeshua was telling them, you know, if you want to hybridize Judaism with Greek culture, and sure, you'll get something tremendously popular, it's going to sweep the world, everyone's going to love it. But it's not going to last. It's not going to perpetuate itself. It's a gimmick. It's not authentic. It's not going to last. So here we see the idea again of linking Greece with the concept of illegitimate hybridization. Right? The Greece is represented here by the mule, by an illegitimate hybridization of different types. Right? So again, this is why... this is the same theme again that we saw with the leopard. Just as the leopard has this propensity for hybridization, right? That represents Greece, which wanted to hybridize, to adulterate Judaism with a foreign culture. And that's why the victory of Hanukkah, it's not just coincidence that it happens to be the miracle of the menorah. There's a symbolic significance to the menorah that we light with olive oil. As the Midrash says in Source 12, other liquids mix together, but olive oil remains separate. So too Israel is separate from other nations. Right? Olive oil doesn't mix together with other liquids, it stays apart. And that's the significance of the Hanukkah victory, that as much as the Greeks wanted to hybridize us with their culture, but we nevertheless managed to retain our distinct Jewish identity. So far we've mentioned two distinct connections between Greece and the leopard. One is, the first idea we mentioned was this idea of brazenness, that just as the leopard is brazen, so too the Greek empire is brazen. And the second idea we mentioned was this idea of illegitimate crossbreeding, of hybridization. But those two concepts are actually connected. If you look in Source 13, the Gemara says that a mamza, right, somebody who is the product of an illegitimate union, is brazen. There you have those two concepts being tied together. Now, why would it be that a mamza is brazen? Any ideas? Okay, well, I'm waiting for your instant messages to come through. I think I think it's simply that the reason why people are generally not brazen, well, what's the opposite of brazen? The opposite of brazen is being bashful. People are not brazen in general because, you know, they feel that they feel uneasy about maybe, you know, how do I explain this? There's a family name to keep up. That is a reputation to preserve. Somebody who's a result of an illegitimate union, right, he has no family name to live up to. He has no reputation. He has nothing to lose. So I think that's a simple explanation. Right, nothing to lose. So that's a simple idea of why a Mamzer is going to be brazen. So there you see those two concepts being tied together. But what's interesting now is that you see this idea of brazenness tying into Hanukkah in another way. Right? Earlier we mentioned that we were brazen, the Maccabees were brazen in terms of them militarily standing up to the Greeks. But if we look at Hanukkah as being an ideological victory, and a victory of Torah, of the Jewish identity against threats to that identity, so we also see that Torah itself is fundamentally linked to the character trait of brazenness. Source 14, the Gemara says, it was taught in the name of Rabbi Meir. Why was the Torah given to Israel? Because they are brazen. Right? Jews are brazen, with chutzpah, right? So, and that was an important ingredient of us receiving the Torah. And the question is why? Why is being brazen an important aspect of getting the Torah? So the Mishnah explains in Source 15, a bashful person cannot learn. Why can't a bashful person learn? Because somebody who just smiles and nods isn't going to get anywhere. You have to be able to challenge your teacher. If you don't understand something, you have to be able to ask, you know, to challenge. Learning Gemara is all about arguing and debating. If you're just going to smile and nod and go along with what anyone says, you'll never reach the truth. You'll never be able to clarify that which you don't understand. You'll never be able to look for where there are holes in the logic and fix it. Right? So that is why brazenness is an essential attribute of Torah study. Right? The Torah study, Torah, which is so integral to the victory of Hanukkah, the idea of Jewish identity, right? So brazenness is an essential ingredient of that too. Now let's look at a very interesting example of somebody who is brazen in terms of Torah study. It's going to seem a little bit off topic, but you'll see how it ends up being on topic. The Torah says that we're not allowed to marry people from the tribe of Ammon and Moab. Right? Verse 16, an Ammonite or Moabite shall not enter into the congregation of God, to their 10th generation shall not enter into the congregation of God forever. Okay? Very historical reasons. You're not allowed to marry somebody from the tribe of Ammon and Moab. Now, the Midrash discusses a verse, Source 17. Okay, there's a verse in Chronicles. It says, Shacharayim fathered children in the fields of Moab after he had sent them away. Chushan and Baara, his wives. From his wife Chodesh, he bore Yovab, Sidya, Mesha, and Malcolm. Okay, seemingly a very boring, mundane verse, just telling you some historical facts. However, the Midrash reads the names of these people allegorically. Allegorically isn't the right word. Homiletically, maybe that's the word. And it reads the names of these people as referring to different ideas. So Shacharayim, who's the father, it says this is Boaz. Right, Boaz of the story with the Boaz and Ruth. Right, it says, why is Boaz called Shacharayim? Because he was free from sin. He was Meshuchar from sin. So here he's being alluded to with the name Shacharayim. Right, it says that he fathered children in the fields of Moab. That means that he married Rus. Right, Rus was a Moabitess. She was from the tribe of Moab. The verse continues, Chushan and Baara his wives. Now, it reads a bit strangely. If you read the verse literally, it's saying that Shacharayim fathered children, Chushan and Baara his wives. It reads, literally, it means that he fathered his wives. Now, of course, it can't mean that he fathered his wives, and in terms of the pshat, right, you have to read the verse saying that Chush and Baara were his wives. But the fact that literally it means that they were his wives, that gives you license to read these names non-literally also, and to read these names metaphorically. So these names, Chushim and Baara, are based on the words Chush and Baara. Chush means to go fast, to pounce, and ba'a means to explain. So the Midrash says, rather it means that he pounced like a leopard and explained the law. Now he pounced like a leopard. What does it mean that he explained the law? Just skip a line here. Skip the last line. An Ammonite and not an Ammonite test, a Moabite and not a Moabite test. Right, all the rabbis in the town were telling Boaz, you can't marry Ruth, she's from the tribe of Moab. And so Boaz said to them, no, it's not true. The verse just says you can't marry an Ammonite or a Moabite. But the deduction to be made is that you can marry an Ammonite test or a Moabite test. So what character trait was Boaz demonstrating here? Brazenness. And even though everyone in town was saying, no, you can't marry her, he said, no, let's look at the Torah carefully. We can figure out what it means. You can marry, I can marry her. Right, so he was using brazenness. So it's interesting, you know, it says that he pounced like a leopard. The way I came across this Gemara is that at the moment I'm writing a Torah encyclopedia of the animal kingdom, right, a comprehensive work, series of works, and every reference to animals in Torah literature. And the way I write it is that for each animal, I have on my computer a CD-ROM with hundreds and hundreds of Jewish works, and I type in the name of the animal and I see what comes up. So on these source sheets are pretty much every reference to a leopard. So, you know, this was one of the things that came up. So at first sight, it might just look like, you know, it happened to pick a metaphor of a leopard. It says that he pounced like a leopard. Could have equally said he pounced like a mongoose, right? Or he pounced like a Komodo dragon. But it's not the case, because what you see is that the metaphors used of animals are fundamental to the way that animals act in Torah literature. The reason why it says he pounced like a leopard and not that he pounced like a mongoose or a Komodo dragon is that he was using brazenness here. Right? He was brazenness, that trait which is the key to learning Torah, is what Boaz used to expound this Torah law. That not to be intimidated by people saying that he can't marry Ruth, that it's forbidden, right? He was brazen like a leopard. That's why it says that he pounced like a leopard. So the mention here of the leopard is very significant. It was like a leopard that he pounced. Now, it's interesting. If we consider Boaz, what else is there about Boaz that makes us realize that he was a brazen person? Anyone want to suggest an answer? What else is there about Boaz that shows that he was brazen? His name. What's his name? Boaz. Boaz. In him is brazenness. Right? So he's brazen by name, brazen by nature. Now, when Boaz, right, in him is brazenness, when he brazenly pounced like a leopard to make this exegesis from the Torah, it was in order that he should be able to marry Ruth. Now, I think this was a good shirk. This was a good match. This was really beset. Because Ruth also had some brazenness in her. How do we know that Ruth had some brazenness in her? Any guesses? Send me an instant message. No guesses? Well, Ruth was from Moab, right? I mean, that was the whole problem here, that she was from Moab. And what was Moab? Who was Moab, you know, the ancestor of this tribe? He was a Mamza. Right? He was the illegitimate result of Lot committing incest with his daughter. And what did we say earlier? The Mishnah in Source 13, it says that a Mamza is brazen. So because Rus was from a tribe that was initiated and was named after a Mamza, a person of illegitimate ancestry, so she had brazenness in her. So this is a great shidduch. You've got Boaz, right? Boaz, in him is brazenness, who brazenly expounds the halacha so that he can marry a person from a tribe of a brazen tribe. Right? Brazenness, brazenly marrying someone brazen. So if you put all this brazenness together, what do you think the offspring is going to be? Brazen, right? Now who was Boaz's and Ruth's ultimate descendant? How does the Megillah of Ruth end? Who was their ultimate descendant? David, right? King David. He was their ultimate descendant. Now, how do we know that David himself So if David came from this brazen person, brazenly marrying a brazen person, he should have been a pretty brazen person too. So how do we know that David, that King David was a brazen person? Tangible mean? Yeah, certainly conceptually. How do we know that King David was a brazen person? Well, you could say that, you know, he took on a giant with a slingshot, but something I like to say even stronger than that. Let's take a look back at Saw 7, at the end of Saw 7. Right, the Torah, when it discussed its whole concept about being as brazen as a leopard and what it means to be brazen, who did it present as the absolute paragon of its virtue? Who did it present as the quintessential example of a brazen person? King David, right? It said that David said, "And I shall speak of your statutes in front of kings, and I shall not be ashamed." That even though he's pursued and fleeing from the heathens, he strengthened his Torah and studies even though they were mocking him. Beautiful how it all ties in. Right? Why is David the quintessence of brazenness? Because he was a descendant of Boaz and Ruth. Boaz in him was brazenness, who brazenly pounced like a leopard in order to be able to marry Ruth, who is from the tribe of Manasseh, and therefore was a brazenness associated with that tribe. So I want to take out from all of this, apart from certain insights into Hanukkah, into the leopard, is just the idea of the tremendous, you know, richness of Torah. That you have all these scattered references in the Torah to brazenness, to Manzerim, to leopards, all of which seem pretty, you know, scattered and irrelevant, but when you put them all together, you know, the whole tapestry ties in together, and you see how these are all interconnected. You see this constant pervasive theme of how brazenness and illegitimate unions and leopards, how it all ties in very beautifully together. Any questions? Actually, I have a question for you. We mentioned this idea that the mule is sterile, right? And this is an important idea in Torah thought, that if you try and crossbreed different species, they're going to be sterile. And that's the idea that if you don't mess with God's world, don't think you can outsmart God. Right? God knew how to set up nature, don't think you can outsmart him. Now, the problem is this. There are some cases of mules giving birth. It's not completely unknown. There are recorded cases, just a handful, but there are recorded cases of mules giving birth. So what do you say about that? Does that undermine this Gemara? Does that undermine this concept? The answer is no. I'll tell you why. There's many, many principles given in the Gemara that have exceptions. The exceptions don't make a difference. I'll give you one example. The Torah says that fish are kosher if they have fins and scales of a certain type. Right? And the Gemara says that everything that has scales also has fins. So that was for halacha. If you see a slice of fish, a fish steak for sale in a store, and it's just, you know, it's just a slice of the fish, so you can't tell if it had fins or not. But if it has scales of the right type, you can eat it. You can eat it because the Talmud says that everything that has scales has fins. Now, a couple hundred years ago, it was discussed that it could be there's other types, right? What if there's other species of fish that have scales and don't have fins? So what many of the halakhic commentaries said is that it doesn't make a difference. It doesn't make a difference. Halakha is not concerned with one in a million exceptions. As long as the rule generally holds true, it's true in a halakhic sense. Halakha is not concerned with the one in a million exceptions. Here's another example. There's a halakhic principle called psik ratio of lo yamus. It's the idea of something having an inevitable consequence. Right? It's like, you know, you can't turn on a light on Shabbos. By the same token, you can't turn on a refrigerator if the light will automatically turn on in the refrigerator, right? It's an automatic consequence. And the phrase that the Talmud uses to describe an automatic consequence is psik ratio of lo yamus, which means when you cut the head off a chicken, obviously it's going to die. Now the truth is, it's not necessarily true that a chicken is going to die. It can run around a bit. And there's even a case of one chicken who had part of his head cut off, and he lived for 2 years afterwards. Mike the Headless Chicken, in the Guinness Book of Records. But that doesn't make a difference. Right? We're talking about one in a million exceptions. The truth of principles is not undermined by one in a million exceptions. So the fact that once in a while a mule gives birth does not contradict or undermine anything we've said. The point is that in general, mules are sterile. Right? In general, the idea is that if you hybridize two different things, the result, because it's not authentic, is not going to last. Okay, that's it for tonight. Happy Hanukkah. Anyone have any questions? Yep, next Monday we'll continue. Actually, that reminds me. I just found out that a friend of mine who's a vet is hand-raising a leopard that was born in the biblical zoo recently and was abandoned by its parents. So I must give her a call. I want to go around and visit it. Don't forget, if you look at my website, you can see the video of the leopard, the zoo rabbi section of my website. I don't know anything at all about fruits. A nectarine is a hybrid? I don't even know. Speciation and there's an idea, you know, there's a prohibition of crossbreeding animals, right? It's the idea that it's showing disrespect for the natural order that God set up in the world. Plums are grafted to peach trees and nectarines. Who knew? Healthy. Speciation is part of the natural order in terms of evolution, yes. But, you know, that's as far as God plans go. The idea of is an idea of you know, ourselves trying to, you know, show God that we know better. Thanks, Amir. Shimshon Rafal Hirsch writes a little bit about speciation and how it ties in with evolution and so on. That is in his essay on the educational value of Judaism, which is in Collected Writings of Hirsch, Volume 7. All right. Have a good night.